Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. ATUK is a not-for-profit amateur astronomy podcast produced by me, Gurbir Singh, an amateur astronomer based in the UK. For more information, see the About and FAQ pages at www.astrotalkuk.org. Episode 38, January the 23rd, 2011. Want to be an astronaut? Book a ticket online. Going into space has been nothing more than a dream for many of us. But things are changing, profoundly and fast. Once, human spaceflight was only possible as part of a national government project. Then, a decade ago, Dennis Tito, on 28th of April 2001, became the very first self-funding astronaut by signing a cheque for $20 million. Now, in 2011, spaceflight has never been easier or cheaper. Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic has now brought the price down to $200,000 for a brief suborbital flight. Imagine, spaceflight for the price less than that of a small house in London. In the year that marks the 50th anniversary of human spaceflight, it's about time, isn't it? A familiar name in the astronomical community, Nigel Henbest, a writer, broadcaster and television producer, took a not too deeper breath and signed on the dotted line and is now on the road to his space experience in the next year or two. As the private sector makes further inroads into this exciting market in the next decade or two, perhaps commercial spaceflight will experience the same rapid innovation and price reduction we experienced in the personal computer market of the last two decades. Is it too speculative to imagine that within a few years the price of a suborbital flight will come down, perhaps to that of a family car? In this episode, Nigel talks about why he wants to go into space and the steps involved in the process of getting there. This episode has an associated video version where you can see the astronaut badge that Nigel describes. Nigel Henbest, you've finally taken the plunge. You're going to space. Why do you want to do that?
It's been something I would have dreamt of since I was a kid. I can remember when the Apollo astronauts landed on the moon, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, back in 1969. I was just a kid on a family holiday, so I didn't even have a TV to watch them, but I had my transistor radio. I was holding it to my ear, listening to them landing on the moon. And I've been fascinated by astronomy and space travel, science fiction, ever since then. And I wouldn't have thought when I was a kid that I could have gone into space myself. And now the opportunity is there. It's something that I really want to do.
All of us interested in space and astronomy, and between us, I think we know quite a lot, would want to do this. What are the forces that have come together that finally made you take the leap and say, yes, I'm going to do it now?
Well, the key thing really is Richard Branson coming along with Virgin Galactic and offering trips into space at a price that people can afford. And that's what got me focused on it. I mean, to be fair, before Branson, it was possible to go up to the International Space Station with space adventures, and there were various space tourists. I think that's a bit of a derogatory phrase, because there have been quite serious people who have done some scientific work when they've gone up there. But to get to the space station for a week on a Russian Soyuz craft costs around about $30 million. Mm. Now, if somebody gave me that money, I would have done that. Yeah. But that wasn't possible. But what came up at the same time was that with Heather Cooper, my colleague in astronomy, and Stuart Carter, the TV producer, we set up a production company called Pioneer, mm-hmm. which has done a lot of programs and series about astronomy and space, space travel, also other factual areas like history. And I was chatting with Stuart a few years ago about Virgin Galactic and the cost of the ticket. And he was saying, well, you know, Nigel, if we bought your shareholding in Pioneer Productions, you'd have the money to go into space. So it's a bit of a no-brainer.
Now, it's not a question of just getting on board. It's subject to training and medical. Have you gone up to your GP and said, I'm thinking of going into space, what do you think?
I haven't. He probably certified me on the spot. what happens? I mean, because I'm a passenger, it doesn't need 6 months of training as it would if you're going to be a serious astronaut or cosmonaut and so on. But what it does involve, as you say, is a very rigorous medical. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's a chance that I'm always going to fail that medical. But interestingly enough, what they did with the Virgin Galactic astronauts was to take the first 100 who applied mm-hmm. and put them through the full medical to see how many of them passed. And you can see, just for financial reasons, they mm-hmm. want to know, was it a 50% pass rate or 90%? Uh-huh. Believe it or not, 95% of the first 100 passed the medical, which I think is wonderful. And again, if you think that these are people with enough money to spend, so they're probably mm-hmm. of an older generation.
Right.
So only 5 out of the 100 actually failed. And one of them, it turned out, had a serious heart condition that he didn't know about. And he was whisked off into hospital and they operated, and he's still alive today. I mean, he will never go into space, but if he hadn't had the space medical, he would have died, probably. And the oldest who passed the medical and the centrifuge test was 89 years old. A guy called Jim Lovelock, who came up with the Gaia hypothesis for the Earth, that the Earth, the hydrosphere, that's the oceans, the biosphere, the living matter, the atmosphere, were all part of one interconnected, sort of, quote, living system. Jim passed that medical and the centrifuge test at the age of 89, and it's reported he came out of the centrifuge with a big smile on his face. So I hope that if he can do it, I hope that I can.
So it's not like the thorough, robust, arduous medical tests that we're familiar with, the Mercury 7 and the right stuff, that kind of thing.
It's interesting. I think about that phrase, the right stuff. To go to space, you don't have to be the right stuff these days. You don't have to be young male test pilot, nerves of steel, and so on. That just about average Joe can go into space these days. Joe or Joan, I should say.
Okay, so let's just work through the stages. When you decided you want to go ahead and do this, how do you go about getting a ticket?
Well, you go to the website. I mean, these days, I think that's the first stage of doing anything in life.
Yes.
so you go to Virgin Galactic, and then you log your interest in becoming an astronaut, and you give some basic background details. And they ask you for a telephone number. Now, I don't like cold calling. I don't like people calling me. I don't generally give my number out. Uh-huh. So that's all that question at all. It was obligatory, so I had to fill it in. But then comments, I said, please don't call me. But I went to the next page, and I thought, I don't want to be derogatory about Richard Branson, but I mean, he likes getting a bit of money into his coffers. So I thought the next page was probably going to say, send your cheque to such and such address, or transfer your bank balance to so-and-so. But he just said, thank you, we'll be in touch. And nothing happened.
Right.
And I was talking to my girlfriend about this, and she said, you said don't be in touch. And I said, well, yes. So unbeknown to me, she reapplied using my name and my details. So I got a phone call the next day. I got really excited. They have phoned me at last. But what they do, I think they want to screen people, just, you know, quick chat on the phone to make sure that people like myself are serious applicants.
I see. So when you go on and say you do want to buy a seat, if you don't have that particular box ticked, it pretty much ends there.
I can only speak from my own experience. Right. I don't know what happened. I mean, my application might have disappeared down into a black hole. A very friendly chap called Dave called me back, and we had a chat about it. Right. And then they got talking about how I could transfer the money. So,
how much does it cost?
Okay. It's no secret, because it's on the website, it's in the media. The full price is in US dollars. Mm. It's 200,000 US dollars. So depending a bit on the exchange rate, it'll be about 150 sterling or something.
Right. And how much have you, surely you haven't paid all of that right now?
They asked for a deposit, and for the first 100 astronauts, they had to pay the full sum up front. And as time goes by, everybody has to pay a bit less than that. So I've still got some to pay off. But once you've actually paid your serious deposit, then you are an astronaut. And you're allocated a place in the queue. So I know that I would be 249, although as time passes, well, some people may drop out for various reasons, in which case I may move up a bit.
So you talked about the key, the founder 100 individuals. Whereabouts are you in the queue?
Well, if you take into say the first 100 are the founders, and then you have the others. So when I say I'm 249, that's from the very beginning. So you've got 100 founders, and then I'm 149 after the 100 founders.
Right. And in terms of the calendar, what does that entail? When do you get into your flight?
I don't know. I mean, they certainly haven't told me that. So anything I say is just going to be an educated guess. I mean, first of all, as of us speaking now, they haven't tested the actual rocket, the Spaceship Two rocket. The way the system works is a rocket is carried up on a mothership or carrier plane to 50,000 feet.
Right.
And then the rocket is dropped and goes up into space, and it comes down and it lands on its little wings on the runway. And so far they've taken the rocket up on the mothership, so they know that's stable. They've dropped it from the mothership when it's come down, and it's glided down to land. So the takeoff, if you like, and the landing phases have been tested, but actually lighting the rocket hasn't been tested. Now, as and when they do that, which should be sometime in 2011, then I guess I'm going to be about 18 months on from now. Right. That's just my guess.
OK, we'll come back to the process in a moment, but Virgin Galactic was set up on the back of the success in 2004 of Spaceship One, the very first privately organised space trip, twice in 2 weeks. And that was in 2004. So in terms of development, what's been happening in that period?
Well, a lot has been going on. As you say, Bert Rutan built the hardware, which actually went into space then for Spaceship One. And well, Richard Branson had worked with him on the gondolas for their various balloon flights. So they were in touch, and as soon as Spaceship One was successful, then Branson got interested in doing a larger version. But knowing the basic system worked, it meant designing how big was it going to be, how powerful it was going to be, how big a plane would you need, how would you design the plane. So just taking the basic concept, you couldn't just multiply everything by two or three or something. Obviously there's a lot of engineering involved in sizing it up. You know, they did have a setback a couple of years ago. They had the rocket was on a test stand, and the test rocket blew up and it killed three technicians. And there's been an investigation into that, and it's not clear quite what went wrong. And so that again has held up the development process. I mean, for myself as a future astronaut, I mean, the more they test these things, the more time goes by to make things safe. It doesn't particularly worry me. So that's on the side of the rocket. I said they now have the mothership. They've flown her. They've got the spaceship, Spaceship Two. They haven't lit the blue touch paper yet, but the actual rocket is there. And meanwhile, what they've been doing is building the launch site, Spaceport America, a purpose-built facility in the south of New Mexico, built literally in the bare desert. Largely funded by the New Mexico state government. So they've just inaugurated the runway, and they're building the terminal building, which is a Norman Foster designed building, so it's the height of architecture.
Norman Foster gets everywhere.
He does. If he has a chance. Well, a bit like Richard Branson, actually. Yeah. Yes. But they put the steel frame up, and they're just putting the cladding on it now, so that's going to be an exciting place to go to. They're going to build a hotel, they're going to build a resort complex, so you can go there with all your family and have an adventure holiday, as well as the astronaut, him or herself, going into space.
So the mothership, or White Knight 2, and Spaceship, the small one, which will actually carry the passengers going to space, is Spaceship 2.
Yes.
So current stage is that although they've glide tested the mothership, White Knight 2, and actually with engines as well, and glide-tested Spaceship 2.
That's right.
They haven't actually used the engines on Spaceship 2, which would actually take you to the suborbital height.
Yes, as of talking now, that's exactly right. Yes.
What sort of engine does Spaceship 2 have?
It has a hybrid engine, which is... rockets generally either have got liquid fuel, like the main engines on the Space Shuttle or the Saturn V, where you have an oxidizer and a fuel, so that can be liquid oxygen usually, and then the fuel could be kerosene or it could be a liquid hydrogen, which is the best one to use. So if you can deal with liquid hydrogen, which is a bit of a beast. So we were, that's a liquid fuel rocket, and the solid fuel is like your firework rocket or the boosters on the space shuttle, where you just have a solid mass of propellant where the fuel and the oxidizer are mixed together as a solid and you just light it. Now, the problem with the solid rocket engine is you can't switch it off. Once you've lit it, it'll just burn. The liquid fuel is much more controllable, but it's also much more complicated because you've got to have pumps pumping things around in a combustion chamber where things burn. So yes, it's more controllable. The hybrid ideally brings the best of those two together because the fuel is a solid fuel, so it looks a bit like a firework rocket with a big hollow down the middle of it, and the oxidizer is a gas which goes down the middle, and you light it as it goes through, and so you get the burning going on all the way through the chamber. So you get the simplicity of the solid fuel design. There are no valves or pumps that you have to worry about once the oxidizer gets in, but it's controllable because if you want to stop it, you can just switch the oxidizer off, and then it all stops. So that's the principle of it.
So it's solid rocket, but controllable because you're using gas as the oxidizer.
That's absolutely. Or some people put it, the fuel is based on like a kind of rubber product which produces a lot of heat when it's burned, and the oxidizer is nitrous oxide, otherwise known as laughing gas. So I'm going up in space on a spaceship powered by laughing gas and rubber.
Well, that should make you laugh, if nothing else. And the trajectory of the flight, as you already indicated, it'll take off from a runway, like a conventional aircraft. 50,000 feet, spaceship 2 will detach. The engine will fire. How high will you go and how long will the flight be?
Well, as you say, the engine fires. It tips up to go up vertically. It fires the rocket engine for 90 seconds. And in 90 seconds, you go from 50,000 feet to 350,000 feet. That's 3 or 4 G's of force for a minute and a half, which takes you into space. So space, I mean, we're mixing our units. I know space begins at 100 kilometres, according to international convention. So that's when we get into space. And then we go up in a trajectory which goes up, and we have six whole minutes in space as we go up, and then we come down again. As we go up, we're obviously strapped into couches because of the G-forces. Once the engine switches off, we're weightless. The couches retract into the floor, so the six passengers can float around freely inside the passenger cabin, look out through the windows, you know, turn around, whatever you do in weightless conditions. And then at the end of those 6 minutes, the couches come back again, and you strap yourself in for the G-forces associated with coming back down again. And then it comes down through the atmosphere, it feathers its way down, and then it lands on its wings back on the runway where you started.
So for those 6 minutes, you have, what, six passengers and two pilots on board?
That's right, yes.
So when it comes to unbuckling and rebuckling, do you have to do that yourself? Is that part of the training?
That will be part of the training, yes. At the moment, there are no plans to have a flight attendant on board. I mean, again, I know there are discussions going on as to whether it would be better if we have passengers who get maybe too excited by the whole experience or just get fumble-fingered. As you say, whether one of those seats should be taken by a flight attendant. That's not the plan at the moment. I don't know how they'll work that one out.
I'm sure that we'll get in-flight meals as well. At this point, it's just six people for that 6 minutes.
Yeah, drinking through a straw, eating through a straw.
And the design of Spaceship 2 is now quite clear. You've got fairly large windows just so that you can actually have a look out.
That's the idea, yes, so that you get the most for your money, really. You can see all the way around you. And I think part of the idea is that because you are weightless, that you want to have windows all the way around, so you get this experience of being in a three-dimensional environment rather than just having a row of windows like you have in an aircraft. But one of the cunning things that they've done, we've talked about the mothership, the White Knight 2, which is basically a very wide wing to take you up to that altitude. The rocket sits in the middle, so you've got two fuselages, one on either side, just for symmetry. Each of those is identical to the spaceship body, so they can be mass-produced. So you've got six passenger seats on either side. So again, Virgin Galactic will be selling those seats to friends and family of the astronauts, so they can travel up with you to 50,000 feet to see you go off into space. So they'll have experience like you used to have on Concorde, going up to that altitude, which you can't really get. So even if you're not going into space, at least you get the stratospheric experience.
Yeah. And presumably, you'll be able to have cameras with you to take photographs.
I don't know this. I mean, I haven't actually looked into this. I'm not sure that I'd want to take photographs, to be honest, myself, because I mean, that's 6 minutes you're going to cherish. I mean, for me, it's a bit like going to a total eclipse of the sun, which is a magical experience which only lasts a few minutes. There's a similarity there. In my first eclipse trip, I took along cameras and all kinds of equipment. Mm-hmm. And then by the time I fiddled around with those, I really missed the eclipse experience. So now when I go to an eclipse, I don't bother with equipment. I know people much more experienced than myself are taking pictures. and similarly, I mean, again, I don't know what Virgin Galactic are planning, but I'm sure that they will have cameras, fixed cameras on board, and I'm sure that, a bit like when you go for a ride at a fairground, you know, they film you screaming as you go down the helter-skelter or whatever. I'm sure they'll be selling DVDs of our experience at the end of it. But obviously, I will check that. Yeah. I will want to have a record of it. But for me, it's the experience. That's what counts. Experience is everything.
That's an important point. The period of weightlessness starts when the engine stops.
Yes.
And ends when the engine starts again, or when the engine doesn't start again, does it?
It doesn't, no. It's when the wings begin to bite into the atmosphere. As you come down again. Well, I think about weightlessness. I mean, it's one of those confusing concepts, because people say, wow, you're going to be away from Earth's gravity.
Yeah.
But you aren't. I mean, you go beyond the moon and you're still within the grip of the Earth's gravity. That's why the moon goes around. So although we're weightless, that's actually because we're travelling with the rocket as it goes up. It's a ballistic trajectory. Uh-huh. So the two parts is really, I mean, the being in space is being above 100 kilometres. Mm-hmm. Being weightless is a bit more subtle, because you can take weightless trips in what they call the Vomit Comet, which is an ordinary aeroplane which just happens to take a path that goes in the right shape to make you weightless for 30 seconds or so. Mm-hmm. So the weightless is more to do with the way we travel rather than the actual height we're at.
What's the maximum G you'll experience coming down?
It's about 3 going up and 4 G's coming down, is what they're saying. They don't like to talk about emergency situations, but I understand that it could go up to 5 or 6 in extreme circumstances. That's not what they're planning on. But even so, I mean, you know, fighter pilots regularly go up to 9 or 10 Gs. I know they've got pressure suits, so they don't black out. But the human frame, provided you are in the right kind of seat or couch, can cope with that.
You know better than most the risks associated with high-speed travel at high altitudes. You scared?
I'm not scared at the moment. When I'm actually sitting in that rocket on the runway, I think it's a bit like going for one of these things in a fairground. That I think I'm sure I get butterflies in my tummy when I actually get there. I mean, there are two things to risk. One is the intellectual way of looking at it, and they're going to do at least 30 test flights of the whole system before the first passenger goes on board. Mm-hmm. Richard Branson is putting his money where his mouth is, or you know, some such phrase, took his family up on the first trip, and I should be about number 40 after that, looking at the numbers. Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing in life is ever safe, so there's always going to be a risk involved. But then, I can cross the road and get run over. You can drive around the M25. For me, I think we all live with risk of some kind all the time, and this is something which I'm not courting disaster by going on this. I mean, there are many things that I wouldn't do. I mean, again, just to broaden the discussion, there are many people who do extreme sports. I mean, I suspect you're probably as likely to be killed skiing as you go going into space, if you look at the statistics, or bobsleigh or something like that, or you could just cave diving. I think it's probably one of the riskier things that you can do. So I think everyone who looks for their own really exciting experience in life is aware that with every exciting experience there's going to be some risk involved in it. And for me, space and astronomy have been with me since I was a kid, so yeah, this is my ultimate thrill, and I accept there will be a risk involved in it.
Okay, let's get back onto the process. You've got your foot in the door, you've paid your deposit. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, there'll be medical and some training.
Yes.
But let's assume that's happened and you've got a date. What's the actual mechanics of it? You presumably you'll have to fly out to New Mexico?
Yes, you fly out to Spaceport America in New Mexico. Mm. And then we have some... With the training, I mean, it's a bit like passing your driving test, really. The theoretical papers, so we'll have to sit in on mm-hmm. say lectures, but so we'll be briefed as a briefing session. I think that's the word I'm looking for. There will be briefing sessions before we go up on all the aspects of what will be involved.
Uh-huh.
We will certainly go up on the White Knight mothership before our actual flight to get the feel for the first part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So... That will be probably for certainly a few days, maybe a week beforehand. Again, I think all the details of this are to be ironed out. There's still time for them to sort out the details of it. And then will come the big day, so we will then be in Spaceship Two itself. And then there's no going back.
You've identified already the 6 minutes of weightlessness. From takeoff to landing, how long is the whole event?
That is about 3 hours.
Right.
Yeah.
So either the morning or the afternoon, half a day, and it'll all be over and done.
That's it.
I'm sure it's exciting. You're looking forward to it right now. How do you think you'll feel after it's over?
I suspect it'll be a huge letdown. I mean, let me go back one step. There'll be two stages. The first will be euphoria. I mean, you land, you've done it. You want to tell everybody how fantastic it's been. You still feel that experience of being weightless. You still... remember the views you saw. I imagine I go to bed that night and dream about it and what it's actually been like to be one of the first. Well, if things go according to plan, that I and the people I fly with will be among the first 1,000 people to fly in space.
Right.
Now, if you think about there's 6 or 7 billion people living on the Earth at the moment, you're one of only 1,000. And if you think of the 100, 200 billion people who've ever lived on planet Earth, and you're just one of 1,000 people who've actually left planet Earth. And gone into space. I mean, it's going to be a fantastic thrill. There will be a euphoria. But then when we go on to, 6 months after that, I think it would be the letdown that I've done that now. That has been, as we've been saying all the way through, that has been the experience of a lifetime for me ever since I was a kid of 7 or 8 when I first looked at the sky. What do I do after that?
Well, by then, who knows? Just as this opportunity is relatively recently, might be other opportunities to go in orbit.
Yes, and in fact, in parallel with Richard developing the suborbital flights, you have SpaceX, which has just launched their Dragon capsule into orbit.
Mm-hmm.
And they are intent on sending tourists into orbit privately. And then you have Bigelow Corporation, which is building space hotels, and they have two prototypes in orbit right now, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. So there was a lot of momentum for the private sector, and allied with change in the American administration, because the Obama administration has now been telling NASA not to spend their efforts in sending people up to the space station, because that's a short hop now, and people like SpaceX... And the European Space Agency has a capsule called Columbus, which could be converted to manned use, which could do that. I mean, sending people to the space station is now possible with private enterprise without NASA doing that. So NASA has been directed really to put their efforts into going beyond Earth orbit. So there's a huge incentive both amongst the private companies themselves and from the American government to develop commercial travel up into Earth orbit, not just a hop. So what we're talking about now with Richard Branson, a suborbital hop for people like myself to be able to afford.
Mm-hmm.
I think certainly in 20 years' time, maybe 10, it would be possible for people to go into orbit, or maybe slightly more than that, but not $30 million a time.
And that's the key thing, isn't it? The pace of development just seems to be accelerating.
Yes, I mean, I know it's not an exact analogy, but if you think about personal computers, we can remember the time when you had to save forever to be able to buy your own computer, and now they come down, and we all know how cheap they are now. And again, we're coming back to Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic, that the people like myself have put our money up front. Once they've built, what they're building initially are going to be two motherships, because they're just aeroplanes which fly down and back again, so they should be able to fly probably twice a day, why not?
Right.
Certainly once a day. Five rockets. And so again, if they can be turned around in a couple of days, you could be you could be launching one of those every day. You know, I don't know what their exact plans are, mm-hmm. but you get the idea that at the end of the day, it'll just be servicing and refueling costs. All the capital costs are being met up front, so the price should tumble. And you know, Branson's idea is that people will not be paying $200,000. He hasn't named a price for what he hopes to get to, but I would imagine going about, say, $20,000. So for what you pay for going a two-week cruise around the Pacific or the Mediterranean or Caribbean or whatever, instead of going for a cruise, you go up into space. So I think you know, as more people do it, like personal computers, the more the price will tumble, the more the hardware becomes run-of-the-mill, off-the-shelf, the more the price will tumble. So we're seeing that now, I think, with suborbital, and I think 10, 20 years' time we'll see that with orbital space flight, it will become within reach of everybody.
Just tell us about the badge you've got on your shirt there.
The badge just here is the Virgin Galactic astronaut badge. Across the top it says astronaut, and then down here it says Virgin Galactic. And the logo across the middle is a young lady flying through space, with her hair streaming behind her. She is actually based on a photograph of Richard Branson's mum, Eve. Because she was what they call an air stewardess. Uh-huh. And there's a lovely, glamorous picture of her in her 20s. Right. And Virgin have actually based this lady here, the Virgin Galactic, on Richard's mother, Eve, who will be flying on the first flight. It was planned at the moment she'll be flying on the first flight with him. And as I said, there are two carrier planes, or motherships, as they call them. And the first mothership has been christened Eve, after Richard's mother.
It's a great name for the very first.
That too, yes.
Yeah, very apt. I'm sure, given the rapid rate of progress, the orbital flights will also be in the realms of possibility. When you go for your orbital flight, can we repeat this then? But in the meantime, writer, broadcaster, producer and astronaut, Nigel, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you.
This episode's quote is from George Bernard Shaw. You see things and say why, but I dream things that never were and say why not.